I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Hey, why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
Yeah, here's Kevin, and today another version of Talking Biotech, and it's the podcast where we really want to bridge the current technologies with the applications where they can help people and take care of issues that we really care about the most. And so much development of new ideas and new technologies, just like any time, whether it's refrigeration, pasteurization, automobiles, many times in history when new technology just is looked at sideways. And people cling to old ideas that thinking that they're better when they're actually sometimes problematic, even deadly. And it's really kind of sad because good technology can really enhance our lives. And anybody who receives medical treatments or enjoys food or an internet downloading a podcast, technology has been tremendously valuable to us and incredibly safe and really giving us a quality of life that generations before us never experienced, and we should be very grateful for that. Today's Talking Biotech is really important because it really explores an alarming problem. And whether you're talking about climate, vaccines, GMOs, whatever, we can think of examples of published work that's just awful. But still, that awful work gets into a journal somewhere and it's promoted by an activist movement as gospel because it confirms their biases. And these works are generally disregarded by scientists because they're published in awful journals, or really low-rent or predatory journals, usually for a fee, and oftentimes without even any review. And still, those works are in the literature and are promoted by activists to attract new followers to that religion and influence the opinion of citizens and folks in the middle that really aren't sure who to believe or trust. And that's the problem. That's a problem. But there's a bigger problem, and this is something that really upsets me and many scientists. What if you work in an area related to an hot-button issue, like something like transgenic crops or the chemicals that are used on them? And what if you're a credentialed, solid researcher, really great reputation, you do good work, publish papers, train students, all the stuff you're supposed to do in a scholarly career? What if, you know, that's, you're doing the right thing. Now you turn a student loose on a rather simple project that still could have very important implications, and you publish those results in an excellent journal, arrive at a conclusion. Now you have a rabid activist movement that takes your work and then makes claims about your findings that are exactly the opposite of what you found. Well, such is the case of Dr. Fiona Young and her paper published in the Journal of Integrated Pharmacology, Toxicology, and Genotoxicity, which is a crazy title for a journal. That's a long one. Her paper demonstrated clearly that there's what it explored using a tissue culture in vitro model was what are the effects of increasing concentrations of either glyphosate, the chemical that's used in agriculture, or a Roundup, its formulation with its surfactants, the detergent-like moieties that go along with it. And she showed that, and her student showed, that that this preparation would kill cells eventually. I won't get into the details too much. At higher concentrations, and we understand why that happens. But there was no evidence of endocrine disruption. But what did the activist movement say? Well, over at GMO Evidence, and if you look on the website, www.talkingbiotechpodcast.com, along with this episode, episode 6, it says, Dr. Young, Roundup herbicide is endocrine disruptor in human cells. And the first line of it, of the article, says, Roundup is an endocrine disruptor, toxic to human cells in vitro, at levels permitted by drinking water. So they're making a claim that is exactly the opposite of what Dr. Young found. And now there's a nice image from those scholars over at GMO USA, where they say, this study showed no evidence of endocrine disruption, but they say, yes, here's endocrine disruption from Roundup, and they have pictures of a fetus in a womb. So here's taking somebody's good scientific work and misrepresenting it 180 degrees for some sort of political agenda. So that's not the anti-GMO movement I know. What about another leader in an anti-biotech movement, a guy like Jeffrey Smith? Now, certainly, Smith would not deliberately misrepresent a legitimate scientific study to frighten people or impugn a technology that farmers find helpful, would he? Well, let's listen to him recently on the television show The Doctors, commenting on Dr. Young's work.
It was released this week that the levels of Roundup that's considered safe in drinking water causes endocrine disruption in human cells as well as toxicity.
And so, fine. It's okay to publish shoddy one-off studies that say transgenic crop technology is and the chemicals associated with it, that they're killing us. So not doing a very good job. Go for it. Eventually, people are realizing that this is the same group of people that continually find some level of harm, and that actual scientists are never finding this. And people are losing their credibility in the anti-biotech movement. They're going away. Even a few weeks ago, Sarah Leaney had a blockbuster press conference, and at best, there was a yawn. Nobody is really interested in what they're selling. I'm not going to give away the punchline of this interview today, other than to say that you can tell from Dr. Young, she's concerned about rigorously assessing the human and environmental impacts of glyphosate formulations. She's a solid environmental toxicologist, great publication record, and I don't know her opinions on biotech, but I'm sure she's very, it would seem to me, just from my read, is that she's someone who looks very skeptically at the environmental impacts and is very cautious and conservative in approaching them. So the interview discusses the actual results of the experiments, the limitations of the experimental system, and why these kinds of experiments are very important. I had a very nice talk with a really solid scientist. So the real question is, why does anyone possibly believe Smith or GMO Free USA or any of the pseudo news sources that blatantly misrepresent Dr. Young's careful science? I'm extremely grateful that she was willing to talk to me about these issues, and she joins me today in Talking Biotech's interview. And today on Talking Biotech, we welcome Dr. Fiona Young, the senior lecturer at the Department of Medical Biotechnology at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia, also a research fellow at Flinders Fertility at the Flinders Medical Center. Welcome to Talking Biotech, Dr. Young.
Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning for you. It's still evening over here, the other side of the planet, but you sound wonderful. So we really wanted to talk to you because I got. I was doing my usual examinations of what material is on the internet, and with respect to transgenic crops and the chemicals that are used on them, and stumbled across a claim about glyphosate, and how this was acting as an endocrine disruptor. And I, of course, was very interested in such evidence, and brought me to a paper that came from your group. And if you could tell me a little bit about why this is a good thing for us to be monitoring, and why you do the kinds of work you do.
This particular story about Roundup and glyphosate is because the regulatory agencies up until now, they look at the active ingredient in a herbicide or pesticide, and they look at a load of different toxicological studies on that active ingredient, which is glyphosate in Roundup, and they set the limits that are permitted in the environment according to that one active ingredient. So that means that here in Australia, if there's 1 milligram per litre of glyphosate in source water for drinking water, that's safe. It's considered safe. It's not going to harm anybody if they drink that. And also there's, I haven't got the concentrations with me at the moment, but they're also set limits for what's safe to be found in water that people go swimming in or boating in or fishing in, the recreational waters, so that if people were swimming in water with that set limit of glyphosate, it's safe. But if the concentration of glyphosate in the recreational waters is higher than that level, it triggers a response in the authorities, and they then have to go and look for the source of that glyphosate, and they have to perhaps clean it up or prevent public access or something. So the importance of monitoring pollutants in the environment is around public health and safety, but it's also around ecological health, if you like, and maintaining ecosystems. The reason I started doing this, though, was because some work by other people, there's a very active French group in this area, showed that the other ingredients in Roundup were also bioactive and were doing things, and it wasn't correct to only assess the toxicology of the glyphosate. It was important. It's important also to look at the surfactants and detergents, the other things that are in the pesticide or herbicide. And I think I've been discussing this with other people who are in the Drinking Water Guidelines Committee in Australia, and the discussions we've been having are around, well, there must be toxicity data on the other components of the pesticides, but they're probably in the grey literature. They're difficult to access, or they may be in the company's own archives. So it looks like it's now public money is trying to look at those things, and that's part of what I was just doing in this paper.
And I agree, it is really important for us to be assessing all of the components as they go into the environment, and not strictly the active ingredients. The surfactants can have biological consequences as well. And so your experiment, could you give us a little bit of sense of the experimental design and why that was chosen?
When you're testing bioactive agents in vitro, I suppose the tradition, classical toxicology, will use liver-derived cells, hepatocytes, because in the body, the liver cells have evolved, I suppose, to take in xenobiotics, foreign substances, to break them down, ready for excretion. And so a lot of toxicology studies in vitro were using hepatocytes. HepG2s is a very popular cell line. Now, the cell line, but of course the liver cells are not designed to make hormones, so you can't test endocrine disruption using HepG2. So I chose a cell line, the JARs, which are derived from a tumour, choriocarcinoma, of the placenta. So they're not normal cells by any long stretch of the imagination. They're cancer-derived cells. But they come from the placenta. And the placenta, a tumour of the placenta, and the placenta, they have properties similar to the liver cells in as much as they can take in xenobiotics, break them down. And so they have some function similar to the liver cells, which is why they're good for toxicological studies. Plus, they make the hormones and respond to gonadotrophins. So they're kind of like an endocrine disrupting version of HepG2. So that's why I chose those.
essentially you're able to challenge different cell lines with different concentrations of a chemical or some sort of chemical, or in this case glyphosate and Roundup, and examine under different concentrations, increasing concentrations, how the cells would behave and how these cells that were still, how placental carcinoma cells, which are competent to produce hormones, how they would produce hormones under these increasing concentrations. And so this way you could tell if there was a change in the way that these cells would produce hormones. And yes, so this kind of study, how do you, how does, when you work in toxicology, is this usually the first line of experimentation you do to kind of define a window and understand where these concentrations are?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very early stage research, because you really only get definitive answers after you've done in vivo studies, animal studies. But we want to minimize the number of animals that are used for research. So you can do a lot of preparatory work in vitro to identify active doses and exposure regimes. So, I mean, the whole premise of toxicology is if it's a short exposure time, so I think I've got some four-hour exposures in this particular experiment, that's a short exposure time. And then you'd need a much higher dose, a higher concentration of the thing you're testing, the toxin, to kill the cells. But if you've got a longer exposure time, and I think the longest I go out to in this particular experiment is 72 hours, but that would really still be considered acute exposure. Chronic exposure would be months. But the longer exposure, often the lower the dose you need to kill the cells. So working out these parameters of dose and exposure can then help to design animal studies if it's needed. If the in vitro dose exposure results, and if the in vitro mechanism of action studies support going forward into animal studies, you can use that data to fine-tune ongoing studies.
And that's really important, as you say, to limit the number of animals that you would have to use. You don't have, at least dials in somewhat of a window where you know there's a biologically, you're in the linear range of a biological response or approaching it. And I know that when I examine the literature frequently, and it doesn't matter whether it's glyphosate or resveratrol or whatever, when you start looking at the way that people tend to interpret these results and extrapolate them to whole organisms, how much of a limitation is there really when we start to make that leap?
Well, you shouldn't. You should not extrapolate from in vitro to in vivo. The in vitro cell culture, cancer cells in a plastic dish, are nothing like I don't know, cells inside a real animal or person. The for example, if you had a glass of water which had a little bit of glyphosate in it, so the 1 mg per litre that's allowed by the Australian drinking water guidelines, for example, you drink it, it goes into the stomach, and whatever's in there gets digested to start with. It's attacked by the stomach acids. And then it's to cross the intestinal wall. It's got to get through the GI tract. And there are a load of mechanisms and systems in place throughout the gut that prevent absorption often of harmful xenobiotics, or there's a whole defense system in there. If it gets through the gut wall, this toxin or whatever it might be, goes into the blood. And there are many binding proteins and carrier proteins, different things in the blood that can either take it straight to the liver or prevent it getting to any target tissues where it might cause harm. And then if it gets to a target tissue, you've got to see what happens. There are a lot of extra mechanisms in the body that are not represented at all in a plastic dish. So, I mean, the sort of shorthand way of remembering it is ADME. So in vivo, in animals and people, you have the processes of absorption, distribution, absorption through the gut wall, distribution through the blood system or lymph or whatever it might be, ADME, metabolism, which is the cell's ability to do something with the toxin, and E for excretion, of course. So there's all these different methods for excreting things. Now, ADME is not generally represented at all in a plastic dish, so you can't extrapolate from in vitro to in vivo. It doesn't mean the same thing at all.
Yes, but and at the same time, it doesn't discount the necessity and the validity of the in vitro work. It is an excellent first step. It's a great way to generate a hypothesis, and a good and a necessary, I think, a wonderful place to begin. And so when we talk about the results of your work, and I guess your work was done along with students, or were they
It was a student prac. Some people that work in postdoctorally with me were very interested, and they were doing these extra experiments as well. So the data sets, one of the data sets is from student prac, and the other data sets are from postdocs.
That's wonderful that you get published as a student, and it's wonderful. So I guess the if we could just kind of walk through some of the major findings of the paper, and I remember I'm going from recollection. I don't have it open in front of me, but you essentially did two major sets of experiments that was analyzing cell growth and then measuring the hormone production in the presence and absence of glyphosate and the Roundup in its entirety. And so could you tell us a little bit more about the experiments and maybe some of the results?
Sure. So these are using 96 well plates, so little plastic plates with buckets in them, if you like. And we put cells in wells. So I can't remember what we started with here. Maybe 20,000 cells in each well. So that allows replication of each dose. We put glyphosate in at a range of concentrations into some of the wells, and we put Roundup on top of the cells with the equivalent concentrations of glyphosate in them. And we exposed the cells, so the cells were cultured with these things for varying amounts of times, as shown on the figures. And then at the end of it, we collected the media, because the cells synthesize progesterone, and progesterone is based on cholesterol, and it's sort of miscible with the cell membrane, so it can just be at equilibrium within inside the cell and outside in the cell culture media. It just floats through the cell membrane. So the progesterone was in the cell culture media. So at the end of the exposure period, collect the media and freeze it, and the cells that were left in the wells, the cells that had survived their exposure to glyphosate or Roundup, we counted how many surviving cells there were in each well by using, I think we used an MTT assay in this paper.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, MTT.
That's
right. So we were able to say exactly how many live, viable cells there were in each well. And then a couple of days later, thawed out the supernatants and did ELISAs, enzyme-linked immunosorbent assays, to measure the progesterone. So then you can relate the amount of progesterone that the cells have made to the number of live cells that were in the worlds. And that's what we did. We did some other odds and ends to look at the reproductive function. So the placental cells, these were tumor-derived cells, but they retained some of the characteristics, usually respond to an embryonic signal and to increase progesterone production. And so we put that embryonic signal, HCG, into some of the wells, and we showed that under control, normal conditions, so no glyphosate, no Roundup, that the HCG did stimulate progesterone production just like it does in vivo. But the glyphosate and Roundup didn't make any difference to that, because the key finding was that glyphosate in the Roundup formulation killed the cells. And then because the cells were dead, they couldn't, of course, make any progesterone. So the endocrine disruption effects, the endocrine effects were secondary, came after cell death. And the glyphosate in the Roundup also didn't affect the activity of HCG, so which it might have done, but it didn't. So really, the definition of the US EPA's definition of endocrine disruption is that an endocrine disruptor is an exogenous agent that interferes with the synthesis, secretion, transport, metabolism, binding action, or elimination of natural blood-borne hormones. But by that definition, what happened in this in vitro setup, this in vitro experiment that we did, glyphosate wasn't being an endocrine disruptor.
And at least under these conditions, it showed just to reiterate, that the dead cells were not synthesizing the hormone. And the dead cells were only occurring in the Roundup formulation, but not the glyphosate on its own. And these are at levels, I should mention, are at levels somewhere between 7 times and, well, these are at 7 mgs per liter up to 720 mgs per liter. Glyphosate had no effect, even at those high concentrations. But the Roundup did actually kill the cells. And so what was happening there, do you think? Was it something toxic and specific about the Roundup, or what was your interpretation?
My interpretation is based on findings by others, actually the French group that have done a lot of this work. The other components of Roundup are surfactants, detergent-type molecules that are, I don't think miscible is quite the right word, but can sort of allow access through the cell membrane. So the other components of Roundup allow glyphosate to enter the cells. Glyphosate on its own is lipophobic or hydrophilic, so it doesn't get through lipid-based cell membranes at all easily. But then when you put it in with surfactants, the surfactants, I suppose, might make the cell membranes more porous, if you like, to glyphosate, so the glyphosate can get in and then do its job, do whatever it is doing.
So really what we are looking at potentially is that we're having a disruption of membranes, or maybe micelle formation, or something that's happening in the presence of the surfactant, which by definition are made to allow products to cross membrane barriers. Is that maybe where we are?
A lot of other people have done that sort of work and have been showing around that. And that's the interpretation that I'm going with as well.
And I'm not criticizing experimental design at all. I just never understand. So I've seen this kind of experiment before with glyphosate and Roundup. Does anyone ever just add the surfactant alone?
There might be. I think there is a more recent paper out. Yeah, there are. There are a couple of papers out that have looked at that. And yes, it did. So that must be, that's where I've got it from about this. There are a couple of papers out there.
Okay.
Well, where they've added POEA and shown, I think they were using the LDH assay. I can't remember exactly what the paper said, but they showed, membrane disruption from that.
And I'll have to double check that myself, because I'm surprised it didn't come immediately to mind, because I watched that literature pretty carefully. But so really what we're looking at least in an in vitro assay, may be that we're just seeing disruption from a detergent on sensitive cell lines that are in culture, and that the dead cells aren't making the hormone.
And correct. So they're not that sensitive, though, these cells.
No?
These are cancer-derived cells. They're pretty tough.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is an immortalized cell line.
Yeah.
Okay, so these things are a little better than other things. I've done some tissue culture work in mammalian cells, and you look at them wrong, and they decide to die.
Yeah, well, the primary-derived cells are like that. So if you get cells straight out of an animal or person and stick them in culture, then if there are undifferentiated cell type like fibroblasts, then you can get them to do maybe 30 generations, 30 doublings, and then they'll die. Mm-hmm. So they're less sensitive than real placental cells might be, or uterine cells might be. So you can get uterine cells from mice, for example, and stick them in a culture, and they probably won't last for 30 doublings, maybe a dozen perhaps if you're lucky. But these are immortalized cancer-derived cell lines. They'll go on forever, so they're tougher.
What were some of the other key findings from the work?
I mean, for toxicology, pharmacology, toxicology studies, you really need to find the concentration that kills cells. So I had to go quite high, get a high concentration to find the concentration of glyphosate that killed the jar cells in vitro. And I found in the end that 16 millimolar of glyphosate killed half the jar cells after a 24-hour exposure. But under the same conditions, you only needed 0.008 millimolar of glyphosate when it was in one of the Roundup formulations. So to kill half the cells after 24-hour exposure. So the toxicity, so the surfactants in Roundup increase the toxicity of glyphosate by orders of magnitude, and that's quite telling. The other, that the glyphosate in Roundup EC50 toxicity is in the same range as the drinking water standards, which is 0.0059 millimolars. So 0.059 millimolars higher than 0.00. Oh no, it's not. It's less, isn't it? So it's the same range, but it doesn't mean that if you drink it, it's going to hurt you. It's just saying that it's justification for more studies, that it needs to be checked and see what it does in vivo. Some of the previous in vitro studies, they were done in acidic conditions without serum. So cells in vivo are really bathed, they're bathed in blood in serum, the constituents of blood. So the sort of equivalent way to say it would be that in vivo cells are in 100% serum. And my cell culture system, we just use 10% serum, so you know, only a tenth of what cells would actually see in vivo. And in vivo, cells are in physiological pH most of the time, and certainly placental cells would be, so around about 7.4. Now, the previous in vitro cell culture tests for glyphosate and Roundup, where they found some evidence of endocrine disruption, were under acidic conditions without serum. And in acidic, no serum conditions, the same cell lines or sister cell lines are, I suppose, they're compromised and they become a lot more sensitive. So I think that those previous results were not, they're interesting for finding mechanisms of action, but they're not quite as relevant for designing future in vivo studies, because the conditions that I used were more analogous to in vivo conditions. So could use these dose and exposure ranges to design an in vivo study, I think.
Certainly, the studies that were done, and many people are critical of those research groups, but I think they are very competent to do that kind of research. And I think if they're guilty of anything, it's just extrapolating beyond the limitations of the assay. And maybe not considering that under the specific conditions they use, there are some restrictions as to how it can really be related or translated to an in vivo system. And I think that's really but nothing wrong with the data. Again, it's a good starting point. It's a hypothesis generator. But now it takes an extra level of experimentation to really get to the answers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that really ties in with kind of the, you know, where I know that your paper made a bit of a splash when on the internet and in other places, where they actually one group actually put your name on it. They said Dr. Young shows glyphosate or Roundup acting as an endocrine disruptor. I think I sent that picture to you. You know, how do you feel about that when it's kind of a very deliberate misinterpretation of what the results actually said?
I mean, I haven't seen it, but apart from the link that you sent, that's right. But I suppose they're non-scientists and they haven't got the scientific training. So they're interpreting a scientific piece of work in incorrectly into lay terms. I mean, people tend not to try and look at physics or engineering thing because there's too many formulae and numbers and it's too difficult. But because these ones are written, you know, there's more English, I suppose, in them. They're reading it, but they're misinterpreting the content. I don't mean to sound patronising, though. There's plenty of people that have got a good understanding. I think it's people that haven't got the training who are misinterpreting it. And I can understand that they misinterpret it because I haven't been trained.
And I agree. I think there's a lot of people who do misinterpret. I think there's a lot of others who maybe know better but still run with it because it can be compelling for their case.
Makes a better story. But, I mean, I think that's why it's important for scientists and other academics to hold the line and be conservative and rigorous and maintain those standards, isn't it?
I think so, and I think that it's also important for us to be fair, for us to say, here are the strengths and weaknesses of the assay, here are the limitations, here's what's really good about it, here are the things that make it a compelling argument for why we need more careful in vivo analysis, and here's the things that maybe we shouldn't be extrapolating. But I think lately, at least in the States, there's been a very strong trend. We have a television show here called The Doctors, where they actually had had one of the leading anti-biotech authors and documentarians on, who isn't a scientist, who quoted from your work and said, we have evidence now just shown that glyphosate is acting as an endocrine disruptor.
Well, this paper doesn't say that. In fact, it says the opposite. Endocrine disruption effects were secondary to cytotoxicity after cell death. By the definition of endocrine disruption, it means that they weren't. It wasn't that.
Exactly, and it's something that really bothers me, because it's not just what happens to you. It happens to lots of very good, legitimate studies that have outstanding, that are done properly, that look good, but have a few buzzwords in the title that an activist community looking for confirmation bias grabs onto those words in the title and then makes their own conclusion. And I knew that it was your paper, but then when I saw the story in, I can't remember what it was, maybe Sustainable Pulse, said, according to Dr. Young, this is an endocrine disruptor. And I was amazed, because I felt so bad for you, because I thought, here's somebody who's taking good work and misrepresenting it for their own cause.
And it speaks to the standard of journalism, doesn't it? Because good journalists will get a balanced view of a story and would have asked me, surely.
That's true. But I think we're talking about a website, not the New York Times, and I think that makes all the difference in the world. So what is next for you? Do you think that you would continue to maybe pursue some of the in vivo studies, or do you imagine, or is your work really just
You can't get the research money to do in vivo studies. But this year's prac with the third year students, so they've only been at uni for 3 years, so they quite like the lab prac exercise, because it is real research, and I get lots of experimental replicates from these students, which is great. But this year's prac, we actually looked at the effects of glyphosate and Roundup on estrogen, and that's looking interesting. So I just do a variation of the prac each year to see what happens. So there'll be another in vitro paper coming out. We've got a few extra things to do around it, but that one's looking interesting. From the point of view of this, there's a lot of discussion around looking at the toxicity of mixtures. So in Europe, they've been doing a lot of work around what is the combined effect of pesticides, herbicides, agrochemicals in the environment, and how do you regulate for that and keep and protect public health and ecological health by looking at those combined things. And from the drinking water guidelines or the recreational water or, you know, environmental guidelines here, it's difficult to say how can we assess mixtures, how can we monitor that, how can we work that into a process. So those discussions and debates are going on in environmental circles, and this is just one little cog in one little contribution to that debate. There are other ones which are far more comprehensive, other studies that are far more comprehensive and important. But it's around this idea looking at mixtures causing toxicity rather than just the active ingredients. That's the important thrust of this work, I think.
Well, I really think it's wonderful that you're doing this kind of research, that you're involving students in the research, and thinking along these lines, because it takes the people. I know I didn't mention it earlier, but you have an extensive publication history in this area and good credibility as a scientist, excellent credentials, and it really is a good opportunity for students to learn how to do these experiments properly, but maybe also to become good good stewards of science communication in the dissemination of these results and how they talk to a public about what they really mean. And I think that's it's why I really appreciated this paper, and look forward to what's coming next.
Thanks, Kevin. That's a lovely start to my Monday.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
That's lovely. Thank you.
So thank you to Dr. Fiona Young, who's a senior lecturer at the Department of Medical Biotechnology at Flinders University in Adelaide, South Australia, also a research fellow at Flinders Fertility at the Flinders Medical Center. Thank you very much for joining us today on Talking Biotech.
What can you do to help spread science through Talking Biotech? Our goal is to advance discovery to application with communication, ensuring the best technology reaches farmers, consumers, the environment, and the needy. Talking Biotech podcast is 100% funded by the Kevin Folta Family Vacation Budget, and no contributions or advertisers will be solicited or accepted. What you can do is kindly take a few minutes and write a short review of this podcast on iTunes, tell a friend, or scratch talkingbiotechpodcast.com into a bathroom stall at Chipotle. If you have any questions, send them to talkingbiotech@gmail.com or through Twitter @talkingbiotech. A podcast dedicated to these important issues is long overdue. Your assistance can help others find helpful information, will accelerate research, and bring innovative solutions to those that need them.
This is Dr. Stephen Hawking, and when I am not thinking about real science, which is not often, I listen to Talking Biotech with Matt Schill. Kevin Folta. Now he can try to answer your questions.
Yes, leave it to, you know, you make out a request saying, do your best impersonation, and somebody does the Stephen Hawking impersonation. You know, I'll give you a gold star, but, you know, I think we can do better. So send your impersonations or your fill-ins on Talking Biotech to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. This is a section of the podcast where I answer your questions, and this week there's one question that came from somebody about, well, actually it's two questions. It says, what do you think of this video, and can you give us a discussion of what it really means? And so this was a video that's all over YouTube, getting lots of widespread play, that's called The Effect of Organic Food. And I'll play a little bit of it for you here, removing the language. It's in Swedish, so not very helpful with the subtitles over a podcast. I suppose I could read them, but anyway. So listen to this, and we'll go from there.
Most of what is grown today is treated with pesticides. That's not so healthy for the environment, but does it really affect us? Meet the Palmberg family. They don't eat organic food. But for the next 2 weeks, the Palmbergs are going to eat only organic. Before they begin, urine samples are taken from each of the family members. And it turns out they have a number of different pesticides inside their bodies. So, everything in the kitchen is replaced, and they begin eating only organic. Then, another round of samples are taken, and now, almost all the pesticides have disappeared.
So what's the criticism? And the funny part is I don't have a huge problem with this, but I'll talk about it. First of all, it's an online video generated by an organic grocery store chain in Sweden. And so it's kind of what you see these days. Let's scare people about food, because if we can scare them away from conventional produce, we can watch our sales tick up a little bit. So that's kind of, number one, that's what we're seeing here, and that's why this has even been done. It was a single replicate test, wasn't from a peer-reviewed study, and a very small sample size. So I see that this is a political and a advertising move more than a scientific move. And of course, if a pro-farming video that was favorable towards conventional food came out and was brought to you by John Deere, people would automatically claim this conflict of interest, blah, blah, blah. Now, I don't like to play that ad hominem thing, so just something worth pointing out. But most importantly, this wasn't a peer-reviewed study. When you look at the data, which they do present in a very nice little report, it comes from one family of several members, one experimental replicate, and generates some very strong conclusions. And still, I think the data are real. They are what we might expect, I would guess. But the report presents the technical means, like the materials and methods seem fine. And one caveat is that they do normalize their numbers. So what they did basically was get urine samples from a family before and after going on an organic diet. All organic diet. Okay, that's cool. And they normalize they test for pesticides, so a variety of compounds of herbicides and insecticides, and they test for the levels of them and normalize them to creatinine, which is a metabolite that's found in the urine. So that can throw off the data in lots of ways because the number fluctuates based upon your age, on your sex, on many different factors. And so it still doesn't change it that much, but it does not allow you to make valid comparisons between males, females, kids, parents, whatever. But let's talk about what they did find. They present this in a way like, look at your kids and family are being poisoned. But what does that say to a scientist? And what it reminds us is that the analytical chemistry methods are extremely sensitive. The levels that they found, if you normalize those numbers, you think about how much they're finding per deciliter and what this actually is in the diet, it's thousands, if not millions of times below any biological threshold for these compounds. So if you detect it, it means it's present, but it doesn't mean that it has any levels that could possibly be having a biological effect. There was no evidence that they were consuming pesticides. Did it come from the environment? Was the 2 weeks prior to the experiment food supplied to them, perhaps? They should have tested the food before to verify that it was actually had something on it. And then after they were able to eat it, see what how this was being mobilized through the body. To just show that there's something in the urine, it could have come from environmental sources, it could have come from many different places. So that throws some more noise and questions into the test. It also shows that these compounds or their metabolites are in the urine, which means they're being excreted from the body, which is what usually happens and why these compounds are used. It's because they move through the body without consequence. So to show something is present in the urine is showing that a compound is being eliminated from the body in a way that it should be eliminated. They didn't screen for organic pesticides. Now this is kind of a red flag, because if they would have looked for the pesticides from organic crops after that second test, they would have found them, especially increases in things like copper, which is a heavy metal, pyrethrins, who knows if they even use rotenone in Sweden. To say that they're pesticide-free is a little bit disingenuous, because you give them 2 weeks without exposure to conventional pesticides, and then their urine is free of conventional pesticides. Then you don't test for the pesticides they would have actually been showing in their systems. So it's really hard to say conclusively that they're pesticide-free, because they didn't bother to test for the pesticides that would have been there. So based on a limited set of data, I'm not surprised they were able to detect chemicals in the urine. That's how they are eliminated from the body. The problem is that this is a very popular and circulating video that has the mission to scare people away from perfectly good food and continue to disparage the use of compounds that are harmless when used properly, the chemicals that we use in tiny, tiny amounts to produce healthy food. So once again, another good debunking, and I hope you continue to talk about this video with people you know, because it's very compelling. It ties in the emotional idea that that we're all being poisoned by farming and by agriculture, when really it just shows that chemicals are present, easily detectable at tiny amounts, and are being eliminated from the body in tiny amounts, as we would expect. If you have any questions, please send them to me at talkingbiotech@gmail.com or put them on Twitter with the hashtag TalkingBiotech. And with that, we'll move ahead to today's interview about carrots. Where do they come from? Why are they gold, orange, yellow, purple? And what's happening in the future of carrots?
Now it's time for Amazing Crop History.
Okay, this is the section of Talking Biotech where we discuss crop domestication and really how a wild weed was brought into human cultivation, how humans bred and selected for a specific kind of crop to give us something very elite for our table today. And with me today we have Shelby Ellison from the Department of Horticulture at the University of Wisconsin. She's a postdoctoral associate, and she's accompanied with Philip Simon, who is a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin, as well as a scientist in the USDA ARS system. So welcome to Talking Biotech.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Yeah, hi there. So I guess what I'm really interested in carrots, and I've seen a lot of the wild Daucus, so species that are out there as weeds. Most people who are listening have seen this at one time or another, that kind of umbrella-like flower that when you break it smells like carrots. And what do we know about where carrots maybe came from or what the wild version was way back in time?
Yeah, this is a question we've put some research attention to in the last couple of years, and use some molecular tools to help answer that question. So when we looked at some diverse carrots from around the world, we found, and I won't go through all the details, but we found a good indication that the center of origin of the species Daucus carota, which is the scientific name for cultivated carrot, and also for that weed that you mentioned, the center, the geographic center of origin of carrot, or center of diversity, is in Central Asia. And that actually matches the written history of the crop, which has suggested that carrot was domesticated as a root crop in Central Asia, first references in Afghanistan, about 1,100 years ago. There's some indication in some records that there may be an earlier domestication of carrot by the Roman Empire, but that is not completely clear. And so for clarity's sake, the definite place that we know of the first cultivated root crop of carrot is Central Asia, and also thought to be the center of diversity of wild carrot.
So what was the evidence that suggested that it was from Central Asia or Afghanistan? What did scientists see?
So what we saw was that the genetic diversity for the Central Asian carrots is greater than other carrots, and that diversity matches the wild carrots of that region. And so that similarity of diversity from that particular geographic region being a match is suggesting that. So,
okay. Yeah, just to expand on that, so we sampled wild carrots from all over the world. And then when we looked at some of our, the youngest existing carrot varieties, or the earliest carrot varieties, we found that they were most genetically similar to those from that Central Asian region.
Okay, so it wasn't actually some sort of records or anything like that you actually used molecular tools or similarity within DNA sequence to actually go backwards and see what matched. Do I have that right?
Well, we did use DNA tools to see how it matched, but there in fact is some written record of carrot as a root crop. And the first clear record is from Central Asia, but it's not extensively described like some crops. The first cultivated carrots in Central Asia were yellow or purple. That's pretty much the extent of information, and there's some drawings that go along with it to suggest that it was in fact carrot that was being described. Then there's some written record about 1,000 years ago, maybe 1,100 years ago, for carrot in places like Iran and Northern Arabia. And about 1,000 years ago then, there's some written record suggesting people were talking about carrots in Syria and North Africa. And then again, more recent records about 1,100 years ago suggesting carrot was grown in Spain and still purple and yellow. So this is all written records up until this point with some drawings that go along with it, but not very clear. Then beyond Spain, in the roughly the 1200s or 1300s, there's pretty good evidence of carrot being grown in Italy, and that's really when the first Oriental carrots were reported in China at about that same time, the 1200s, the 1300s. Before that point, I haven't seen any clear evidence of carrot as a root crop in Asia. And then it was reported more extensively in Europe in the 1300s throughout all of Northern Europe and also more extensively in Japan, in the case of Japan, only in the 1600s. So there was a written record for sure, a few drawings to go along with the written records in that time period. And we felt we were lucky in some ways, or I don't know about lucky, but we felt happy about the fact that our observations coincided roughly with that written record. And I'll also point out that Vavilov, the famous plant explorer, also thought that carrot originated as a root crop in Central Asia.
Okay, so was most of the radiation from those Central Asian origins, was most of that radiation due to human trafficking or human movement of this? Is that how you think?
Probably, well, as a root crop, probably yes. But it is known that carrot occurred in Europe, Switzerland and Germany, as long ago as 5,000 years ago, so much earlier than the first cultivated carrot. So it's been a successful weed around the world for a longer period of time than it's been a successful root crop.
And so when you look at the differences as a root crop, as this thing has been moving around and has been migrating, what are some of the principal differences that one would notice in the crop itself if you compared, say, modern carrots versus some of the earlier wild varieties?
When we talk about wild carrot, what you can picture is Queen Anne's lace, which grows in the ditch and along the road just about anywhere that you can imagine in the United States, but also all over the world. And that Queen Anne's lace, if you look at the vegetative part of the plant above ground, looks quite similar between domesticated and wild carrot. But most of the things that we have selected through domestication are what's occurring under the ground or with the root system. So a wild carrot root actually will be have more of a fibrous root system. So it won't have that primary taproot that we associate with domesticated carrots. Additionally, wild carrots are unpigmented, so they lack the carotenoids or the pigments that we see in domesticated carrots. So they generally would be white, fairly woody, kind of fibrous, and then have many lateral roots extending off of that taproot. So we've selected for this increase of different pigments, and as Phil had mentioned earlier, from the initial selections were likely a yellow or purple-rooted variety, and then later on, another selection was made out of the yellow varieties into an orange variety, which is what we're most familiar with now. Several other pigments, we have red variety carrots as well, so an increase of lycopene. So the pigments were one of the primary features of domestication, but then also that the enlarging of that taproot and different shapes of carrots that are preferred in different cultural markets. And finally, there's definitely an accumulation of sugar that occurs in the taproot now as compared to the wild relative.
As carrot breeding is going forward, are people finding that today's markets in the industrialized world are more interested in some of the novel colors and flavors, or what are the modern breeders using as a selecting for? What are they looking for?
Yeah, that's a good question. Before roughly the 1980s, almost all of the focus for breeders was on orange carrots. And then a part of the motivation for going back to some of these earlier colors, which interestingly consumers today view as new colors, was novelty because of the interest in developing niche markets. But also, a part of the motivation was the fact that the nutritional and health scientists had found that some of these pigments in carrots are of some nutritional value. So, so there's been several motivations for going to a broader range of carrot colors, but they're very distinctive colors, and the pigment content is quite high in these diverse colors.
Yeah, I always found it to be really surprising at the diversity of colors that were present in carrots. That I never, to me, I've always thought of carrots as this orange thing, and never really noticed until I bought some seeds that had the whole series, and it was amazing how interesting they really were. And going forward, though, are there other important traits that breeders are either selecting or introgressing from wild carrots? Anything to do with disease? Because it seems that this stuff grows everywhere pretty well as a non-cultivated crop.
Yeah, it does grow very well. And let me just mention one thing about wild carrots in North America that we discovered is every indication is that the wild carrots that we see in North America came from Europe, which was a question we were wondering about. And that, again, is based on molecular markers. So our guess is that probably wild carrot came over with the European settlers in the 1500s or thereabouts. But anyway, that's off the track a bit. But traits that were... So one interesting thing about wild carrots, I think, is worth noting is that pretty much all the carrots you get in major grocery store chains coming from the large-scale growers have the cytoplasm of wild carrots. And that's because the system of developing hybrid seeds in carrots comes from a wild carrot source that actually was originally out of North America, a wild North American carrot. And so I think that's worth noting in general, because I think it's an interesting fact that the mitochondrial genome and probably the plastid genome of the vast majority of cultivated carrots you get in big grocery stores, orange carrots, has that wild carrot cytoplasm because of its essentiality for developing hybrid seeds.
So it has the cytoplasm because the wild carrot was the maternal component of the hybrid cross?
Yes. That the cytoplasmic male sterility system... it comes from wild carrot, and it's a very good system from the standpoint of good in producing clear hybrids on a very large scale.
I see. So this is because the maternal parent can't produce viable pollen, which makes it ideal for crosses, because any seed you get are going to be hybrids if you plant them in proximity to the pollen donor.
That's right. And carrot flowers are very small, so the idea of hand pollinating carrots to make hybrids is not going to go anywhere. So,
no, that's really good. I wanted to clarify, just because I'm not a plant breeder by training, and I do encourage people to get excited about plant breeding, and just to think about some of these tools that are available in different species really does help facilitate what could be a very difficult. Like you say, hand pollination is probably out, and insect and wind pollination, sorting that out on the backside is probably difficult too.
That's right, yes. And it's an interesting fact, because when you look at orange carrots you have some idea of wild carrots that Shelby mentioned, these white fibrous rooted things, it's hard to imagine that there's much of a link between the two, at least in the modern sense. But in fact, breeding into that wild carrot is something that was undertaken in the 1950s, and by now that it is the system for producing hybrids in the crop. So you were asking what other traits we can find in wild carrots, and we've been pursuing a couple of these already and have some other ones in mind. The wild carrots look to be a source of some valuable new genes for resistance to a couple of diseases that attack the carrot crop. One of them is alternaria leaf blight, which is regarded as probably the most devastating disease of carrots globally. It damages carrot leaves, which translates to impeding the growth of the crop and making it it just hurts the growth of the crop, and also interferes with the harvest of the crop, because often carrots are harvested by machinery or people pulling on the leaf. There's some good alternaria leaf blight resistance in wild carrots, which there's been some effort to move into cultivated carrots. We've also found some resistance to root knot nematodes in wild carrots that we're looking to move in by breeding into cultivated carrots. Those would be a couple of examples of disease resistances that we have some promising indications of using wild carrots to move into cultivated. I will mention that we have found resistances to these diseases in cultivated carrots as well. And so it's not an exclusive source of resistance, but we look to these wild carrots as sort of the ultimate source of some of these more broadly variable resistance, genetic resistances that you're pursuing.
And what about, are there any really far out traits that you're trying to introgress in? Anything else that has to do with maybe appearance of the carrots or maybe nutrient content, something consumer oriented?
So, along with the pigments, so I don't know if you've heard the expression "eat the rainbow" before, but it's where it's good for you to eat a variety of colors because normally those various colors translate into different nutritional benefits. So, with some of these orange varieties, we're making crosses with different purple types, which are high in anthocyanins, which are known to be antioxidants. And so what you get are very interesting phenotypes where the carrots might look like a bunch of concentric circles where it'd be a purple exterior and then an orange interior and then sometimes even maybe like a bullseye where you'll get another pigment in the center of the carrot. And we can do this with lots of the different colors. And there's also some traits that make them look like candy canes where there's striped and very strange arrangements, but all of that is very visually pleasing to the consumer and novel, and chefs like these type of things. So we've been experimenting with some of the pigmentation patterns as well as just the pigments themselves.
Yeah, that gets me pretty excited because I think of anything you can do to get a consumer to choose a carrot over a payday bar is a step in the right direction. And especially with kids, and I think the novel flavors and colors are just such a cool part of our current molecular toolbox. Is there a carrot genome sequence that's available?
Yes, and we're going to be publishing it this year. We're submitting it probably within the next month or two. And it's a joint project between our lab and Alan Van Dyne's lab out of University of California, Davis.
Well, very good. How big is that genome?
That's a little bit smaller than rice, so it's about the same, roughly the same size as rice. Shelby's got some specifics, I think.
473 megabases.
Okay, so for those listening, it's 473 million A's, G's, C's, and T's that make up a carrot, which, in comparison to most plant genomes, is relatively small.
It's very nice.
Yeah, so that's a pretty manageable genome. So what's next in the world of carrot breeding in terms of, so I asked about consumer traits, but is there any other real breakthroughs coming forward? Anything else that you'd like to talk about?
I'm not sure about breakthroughs, but I would say it's an area of refocus for me. When I started working on carrots, initially the first trait I was looking at was flavor, to understand if there's a genetic basis to flavor, which there is a very strong genetic basis, it turns out. And the idea that while we're interested in having nice, smooth carrots that have a uniform color and then these bright colors and rainbows of colors, those are great things, and you can actually estimate nutritional value of carrots, at least attributable to those colors, based on a visual evaluation. But our impression is that when it comes down to it, at least for repeat consumption of carrots, flavor is going to be the variable that is of greatest interest to the consumer. Somebody might be willing to take one bite of a carrot of these novel colors, but to get them to eat more, we're interested in pursuing the improvement of flavor. So in that regard, pretty much everybody that we can get information, feedback on, says they would like a sweeter carrot. And so we have been breeding for sweeter carrots, and we will continue to do so. that's a relatively straightforward trait to breed for, and one that I anticipate we can make some good progress in. We're also looking at breeding for, in from a flavor standpoint, breeding for carrots with a sort of an intermediate amount of the compounds that just give carrot its carroty flavor. Those same compounds, if they're too abundant, give carrot a kind of a harsh turpentine flavor. And if they're too low in quantity, then the carrots almost don't taste like carrots anymore, which maybe some consumers would like, but we'd like people to like carrots as carrots. And then we're also looking at texture. People like juicy, crispy texture. That's a more challenging trait to breed for, because what we consider a juicy, crunchy, burst-in-your-mouth texture from a producer or grower standpoint is a carrot that is more prone to breaking when you're pulling it out of the ground and moving it around. And so we're interested in having a better understanding of this whole texture aspect of trait of carrots, in addition to the sweetness and this turpentine harshness. So those are some areas where we're putting a lot of emphasis, but along with the traits that the grower needs, like disease resistance and good general appearance, and then the other consumer traits of the visual color. So those are some of the major focal areas for the breeding project right now.
Yeah, I think colors and flavors is a hot way to go, and I didn't really know the carrot breeding priorities. You know, I don't follow carrots very well, but I will now. So thank you for the introduction. So I grow carrots, and I enjoy growing them in the garden, but it seems like they just get started so slow, and it'd be nice to be able to differentiate them from weeds better. What's being done in that regard?
We've recently turned our attention to carrot tops, not only from the standpoint of resistance to leaf diseases, foliar diseases, but also from the standpoint of the establishment of the crop in the field. Carrot, as I think anybody that's grown carrots in their home garden realizes, is not a very quick grower early in the season. And what that translates to you, those of you who grow carrots, is a carrot is a crop that takes more weeding attention early in the season. And from the standpoint of someone that wants to grow a carrot crop without herbicides, that large top, a quick top growth, is very important. So we have put some attention in recent years to breeding for larger top size on carrots, and for starters, we're just trying to get an idea of what the genetic basis of that trait is, and then looking at breeding for bigger top size from the standpoint of a crop that is going to be able to compete better with weeds.
Okay, so Dr. Philip Simon and Dr. Shelby Ellison from the University of Wisconsin, and Dr. Simon from the USDA ARS, as well as a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin. Thank you for telling me and the rest of us all about carrots. They're where they came from and where they're going. And so that ends another episode of Talking Biotech. Thank you very much to Dr. Young and Drs. Ellison and Simon for speaking with me today. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you for your questions. And let's just keep talking about biotechnology and the things it does well, the things it can do better. But most of all, keeping in mind that this is another tool in the toolbox that helps farmers do what they do and helps continue to ensure what we have now, which is the safest food supply the world has ever known, with the most abundance and most choice. My name is Kevin Folta, and we'll catch you next week on Talking Biotech.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.